Well, I feel like it's been a long time coming, Greg. I feel like I've been talking about you at least for the past three episodes consistently, but definitely for more episodes than that. And I'm really excited to have you on. And if people aren't aware who Greg is, this is Greg Shire. He's the creator of Insomnia, which is a REST and a GraphQL client. And he's been a friend of the show for quite a while. So welcome, Greg.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's always weird to like hear my name mentioned on the show and not be able to participate in the conversation. So it's good to be here.
I'm always hoping that I'm not like misrepresenting what you're writing about or what you said to me in some fashion as I go on a rant. But yeah, I was really looking forward to having this conversation with you, and really looking forward to having you on the show again, because you know we've mentioned you a lot. But also, you're one of the people that sort of has had a big impact on my life in the last six months or so. In just sort of sharing advice, sharing your life experience, just sort of being open and being willing to answer questions that I have. And I'm trying to remember how that even got started. Maybe it was from Twitter. Do you remember how we initially got in touch?
I remember one of my friends, Brandon, he mentioned that you mentioned Insomnia on the show, which is how I figured out about the show in the first place.
Okay.
So I might have tweeted about it, and then I think you reached out to me initially on Twitter.
Yeah, I do that a lot, which I've talked about a lot too. But that's been really great for me just to meet people, because I'm pretty introverted in person, and I don't go to hangouts and stuff like that, meetups and stuff. So Twitter's been instrumental for me just meeting people. But yeah, like as I mentioned, you've always been really open with me and just willing to talk and share life experience and answer questions, and I've been really grateful. And I wanted to have you on so we could talk shop, you know, talk tech, but you know, a lot of the things you've been writing about and thinking about recently have really struck a chord with me and have been very timely with me. So I wanted to talk to you about that on the air, and hopefully that, you know, that strikes a chord with some more people.
Yeah. Where should we start?
Well, we should start, I suppose. I had a couple of people tweet at me after I started talking about Go a couple episodes ago, and that's your fault, because you've been talking favorably about Go for a while, and so over the holiday break, you know, I started kicking the tires. And so really, I suppose I just wanted to ask, like, you know, like what made you interested in Go in the first place? It seems like you've been using it for a long time.
Yeah, I think probably around 5 years now, on and off. I started using it at the last company I was at. We were building an API for our customers, written in Python, using Django actually. And we were getting, like, we were building an API to send emails. So we had a lot of traffic going through our system. And Python, I don't know if anyone's ever, or if anyone listening uses Python. I know there's a lot of Elixir folks here. But Python is not super performant, and if you need to do concurrency, it's fairly complicated, and there's just a lot of memory overhead and stuff. So I think I heard about Go around that same time. It had just came out a few years ago. So basically tried building a microservice in it for one of the things that we were doing, and it ended up, like, I ended up really liking it. Super easy to do concurrency, super small memory footprint, like in the megabytes instead of the hundreds of megabytes, and just super fast and reliable. So, and I think you mentioned on one of the previous shows, like, you can basically learn it in a day. It's a super simple language.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, when I started digging into it, the language primitives themselves are really, really simple. I think where I started to taper off a little bit was get some more community guidelines, like, here's how you should structure a Go application. And it's more open-ended. So I sort of likened, when I was talking to Rockwell, I likened it more to, say, like JavaScript or Node, where there might be some conventions, but there's not like a blessed way as far as Golang is concerned as a community, as far as I could tell anyway, to structure things or go about certain things.
Yeah, I think it's extremely similar to Node.js in that way. Like, Node doesn't really have any, like, extremely, I don't know, structured web frameworks. Like, there's no Django for Node, there's no Rails. Like, you just have to, like, cobble together pieces using open source libraries. So everyone's app ends up looking different. And because it's JavaScript, like, JavaScript does so many different ways and so much baggage around it. It's just so hard to figure out what the best way is to do things. I think with Go, it's becoming a bit better because people are starting to... It seems like the community is starting to care more about that stuff. So people are writing more blog posts. There's just more like example projects out there, like bigger libraries to look at. And they all seem to be doing things in a more similar way now than like as compared to 5 years ago.
That was one of the bigger selling points to me in when I was sitting down for holidays and thinking, because I was weighing in my mind, like, should I play with Go or should I play with C#? And that was one of the interesting things to me was that, A, the language was simple. So picking up C# would be much, you know, much larger undertaking. But B, some of the people that were sort of, I don't want to say reviewing the language, but sort of talking about their experience, they were saying that the language is so simple that typically there's like a way that you do something. And so across projects, things are done the same. And so you don't have sort of this, the effect that you mentioned with JavaScript before, where it's hard to find like a concrete standard. And that was really appealing to me because I do like a good set of rules. And I mean, beyond that, like Go, it's not that Go imposes a bunch of rules. It's so simple that there's just like the easiest way to do something is almost nearly the only way to do something.
Yeah. And it's also like a disadvantage as well, because things like, I don't know, there's certain things that are just more verbose than other languages, like error handling, for example. There's not really a way to throw exceptions in a clean way. You sort of have to pass these error objects around and return them from your functions. So that means every time you call a function, you have to like check if the error result is an error. If it is, handle it. Otherwise, continue on.
Mm-hmm.
And like looping is the same. Like there's only one way to write a loop. Which means like, there's no way to do like a MapReduce algorithm in Go in a clean way. You have to like just write a loop, and you end up right. with a lot of really verbose code, which feels bad at first. But after you get used to it, it's like, oh yeah, I come back to my code 3 months later or 6 months later, and it's like super obvious what it does.
Yeah. So in my mind, it's like it almost keeps you from being clever in a way. And by that I mean, like you said, there's only one way to do a loop, so you sort of have to do it the same way every time. But exactly like you said, you come back to it, it's completely apparent because you weren't able to be clever. You just, you know, there was one way to do it, so you did it that way. It's not like you, I guess one thing that that kind of plagues me with DK's codebase specifically, and this isn't anything against Elixir, but it's like I'll have an epiphany about a paradigm or like a pattern, and I'll implement it, and then a month later I'll forget about it. And so that way in the code base, you can kind of see like, oh, this is the shape, this over here is that shape, this over here is that shape. And I can, you know, figure it out, but it's, you can still clearly see, I suppose, like the differences in patterns or differences in learning there.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. It's sort of like up to you to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And the error thing too, like that's very similar to Elixir, where Elixir, we throw around these things called tag tuples all the time. So it's just a tuple or a tuple, I suppose. Someone will tweet at me about that. But, you know, we'll get a tuple back that says like, okay, or it's like maybe if you're updating a post, you'll get a tuple back that says okay, and then the post in the second position. And if there's an error, you get a tuple back that says error, and then whatever the error message is or construct is, right? So in Elixir, you're sort of constantly thinking about if there was an error and handling it as well. And I kind of like that about Go. In fact, I had a code snippet that I was talking to in a Discord, a Go. I don't remember the exact name of the Discord, but I'll share it in the show notes. But I posted some code there, and the first feedback I got was like, you're not handling your errors, buddy. Go back and fix it, and then come back and ask for help. I was like, all right.
Yeah, yeah, because you know when you're going to run it next, you'll get the error and figure it out on your own.
Yeah, yeah.
But that tuple thing, like, I'm a tuple guy. the tuple thing, Go is very similar in that way. And like, I've still never used Elixir other than like just like browsing the docs here and there. But based on what you've said about it, it's actually very similar in a lot of ways. Like you return an error, like sometimes you have like you're querying a single database item, you might return the item, an error, and like a Boolean to say if it exists or not.
Yeah, exactly. Or even in the case of a little bit more advanced case with Ecto-Maltese, If you're performing a multi-step transformation on something, it's cool because you get a three element tuple back through the whole way. So if the thing errors, you get a tuple back with I'm trying to remember the signature now. It's an error. It's like denoting that there's an error, and then it was the struct or like the error message or the construct, the thing that's describing what happened, and then the changes so far. So you could actually tell like how far into the multi-step operation you got and in which step it failed and all that stuff. And you sort of pair that with pattern matching. So you're able to say if you're passing the result into other functions, you can just have two function heads, one function, say like do something that handles a success case. And it's the signature is matching on the success, tuple response. And then you'll have do something that's, purely geared towards handling the errors. And so things become really, really clean in that sense. You don't have this muddying of branching in the same function body, I suppose.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah. I sort of wish Go had more patterns like pattern matching. Like I used pattern matching briefly when I dove into Elm, and it was like life changing. Like it's so nice to use. It is maybe a little bit opaque at first if you aren't too familiar with it, but once you get used to it, it's just like, oh yeah, this case matches and this happens and this one matches and that happens.
Yeah. So you just mentioned something. So you mentioned Elm, you mentioned Python, talking about Go. And it seems to me that like every time I mention a language to you, you have some sort of passing familiarity with it, whether it's Java or C# or whatever. But you're using Go as your daily driver. I suppose some of that's just because Insomnia's backend is in Go. But it seems like a lot of your, I guess I might be misrepresenting that, but your most recent side projects have all been written in Go, right? Or a lot of them?
Yeah, all the backends. I play around with Django here and there just because Django is so productive to get up and running. But I'm not super familiar with it, so it's like I still have to learn it in a little bit. I still have to get more experience to be super productive with it. Go is less productive, but because I know it so well, it's just the thing I gravitate towards.
Yeah, I think that's what exactly I was going to ask was, I was going to ask, are you picking Go because A, you're really familiar with it, and B, because you're able to be productive with it really quickly?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I know how to host it, I know how to like write tests, I know how to... Like, I got a Docker container that I use for all my Go projects that I just spin up. So yeah, it makes it really easy. And then on the front end, I usually experiment a little bit more. Typically not using the same front end stack for any projects. I don't know where that comes from, but I just like playing around with that stuff. It seems easier to play around in that area than to play around with like DevOps and different backend languages.
Yeah, it feels like... So I've been using Elixir for a few years now, and jumping back into Go, I felt like just difficult to learn how to do anything. I was like, okay, if I want to make a database now, do I pick an ORM? Do I not pick an ORM? Which ORM do I pick? Is there a repository pattern or library that I can use for Go? Am I stuck with an Active Record pattern library? You know, so that sort of that song and dance, I guess, where if I'm really wanting to like ship a project, I would probably just choose Elixir and Phoenix because that's what I'm familiar and productive with. But I don't know. I mentioned a few episodes ago that your posts about side projects really helped me sort of break out of that mentality of anytime I start a new repo or start a new project, I don't have to approach it. It's just like I'm starting a business and it has to be streamlined and I have to be very efficient. You know, it sort of gave me the freedom or license to experiment and play around and learn again.
I was like that as well for a long time because I knew I always wanted to start my own business and do my own thing. So every project that I did, I had that in mind. But now that I have done that, like I have started my own business, like now side projects are more about learning for me and just experimenting and having fun. So I've been doing, like I have sort of a strategy that I follow now, which is I'll have a number of, I guess, a small number of projects that I have implemented before, and then I'll sort of choose a new technology to learn and implement the same project with the new technology. So it sort of like takes the part about building, like deciding what to build out of the question, and then you just get to focus on the actual tech itself.
Yeah, it, well, also on top of that too, I think it also answers a lot of, or removes a lot of questions around how should this be implemented, or like what's the problem that I'm trying to solve here, or what are the feature sets that I need to build for this. So you can purely, like you said, purely focus on the tech. That's a really good idea.
Right. And it's so much different when you're like running a company, because like company's all about building a product and shipping it. So if you're like playing around with tech and trying to learn new tech, like you basically can't do that, because you should be doing like you should be doing the important stuff, which is like talking to customers and figuring out what to build.
Right.
Like those two things don't really mix very well together.
Yeah, yeah. So what kind of side projects do you have going right now?
Well, I think it was a few episodes ago you were talking about Live View. Well, you've been talking about it for a while. And since I don't use Elixir and I use Go, I was like, maybe I can build a Live View. Well, first I did some Googling and saw if, like, I tried to find out if Live View already existed for Go, but it turns out it doesn't really, nobody's really started on that yet. So I just, like, last weekend I was playing around seeing if I could implement something like it in Go, and I got a little bit of the way. Like, I ended up with a proof of concept that could refresh elements on the page. Not through a WebSocket, just through like an AJAX request, essentially.
Sure.
But it was really cool. Like, super fun. Like, I'm digging through the Elixir docs on Live View, which don't really exist, and trying to figure out how it worked without actually using it.
Right. Yeah. You'd have to. So there are a lot of docs. They're not published. You have to go to the source to find them. But you're right. It's difficult. Even for me, like being familiar with Elixir, playing around with Live View is hard, because there's just so much stuff that you have to find in forums or the Elixir Slack or something to know exactly how it works. I think more recently, maybe there are more blog posts coming out about it, but yeah, it's pretty scarce on the resources.
Yeah, there's a few blog posts that show you how to use it, but not, they don't explain in detail how it's implemented. Like, I had questions like, where is the state stored? Is there a central store on the server, or like the docs make it seem like the state's passed down to the client and then back up every time, but like I couldn't verify it, because I couldn't run it.
Yeah, I'm definitely not a Live View expert, but yeah, that you're starting to get into like OTP land, where this, you know, a lot of the state is stored on the server, whether it's in you know, the process that's running, or whether you store it in ETS or something similar. And it basically, yeah, it does send the state across to the client, so that way you can kind of sync things up. But yeah, I would have to defer to Rockwell, because he's used Live View way more than I have at this point.
And speaking of the like labeling your side project, like I implemented that in I think like 4 or 5 hours, and then like now I just like I learned a lot by doing that, and now I have like no desire to continue working on it.
Yeah, so I was going to ask about that too, because looking at your blog stuff, you have a lot of like stat tracking that you're building yourself, like you're sort of rolling yourself. And you mentioned earlier, sort of like you sort of implemented a bunch of different things with Go, and so essentially those, solving those problems with Go become tools in your Go toolbox that you can use at your business or a different side project or whatever. And that just, I don't know, it seems really cool to me, because I probably wouldn't have thought to like, oh, I'm just going to build my own stat tracking into this site that I'm rebuilding.
Right. And I think that's like a common pattern for me. And it's actually how I started Insomnia. Like I needed a tool to interact with like REST APIs, and I saw Postman existed, and I was like, I don't really like this thing. It's a bit complicated. I wonder if I could build it myself. So I did. I built like a super simple version at first, just to send JSON to an API and get JSON back. And like, then I just kept working on it. Like, and the analytics thing was the same. I'm like, Google Analytics is kind of a pain to use, and it's like it's not very good for your users' privacy. Like, I wonder if I could build, like, just build that as an experiment in Go.
Right.
And I'd done some, like, a little bit of analytics backend stuff at my old job. So, yeah, I just spent a couple of days on it and got an MVP done, and just kept working on it, kept improving it. And that's a good thing about having, like, I know you want to get a personal site up and running. I think that's a super good reason to do that, because it's just like a way to experiment on different things without like worrying about customers, like downtime and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah, because you wrote a post about why you kind of ditched the static website that you had, and you know, a lot of the points that you make in it are good, you know, like, you know, you end up tinkering a lot with the markdown, and it's sort of, there's a lot of what's the word I'm thinking of? Friction, I guess. Friction. There's a lot of friction for you from like writing to deploying the site, right? And you wanted something that you could deploy and you could edit posts without having to think about any sort of programming. You just wanted to be like in write mode.
Yeah, it's, I guess, like maybe an analogy is like, maybe you're like building a sculpture out of clay. You want to touch that with like your bare hands. You don't want to be wearing thick gloves or like using like a big long stick to do it. Like for me, writing is sort of the same. Like I want to be writing on the site itself and have those sort of be one thing, because like in my head, the writing is sort of part of the website and the website like complements the writing. So for a static site, I didn't want to like have to write it in my text editor or like use one of these headless content management systems. It just seems too disconnected. Like it's hard to explain, but it feels so much better when you can just hit an edit button on your live website and like fix a typo and then it's saved and live right away.
Yeah, there's just less hoops to jump through, maybe. Like less. So it's sort of like when, this might be a silly analogy, but like when I'm at the dog park with my dog Watson and I throw a tennis ball and he gets halfway to me with the tennis ball and then hooks left because a motorcycle drove by. And so he's trying to bring the tennis ball to the motorcycle. You know, his original task was bring me the ball, but he saw something else over here move or something. Basically, there was a distraction, right? There was a bird could have landed on the fence and he would have went to the bird with the ball, you know?
Right. It's like a context switch.
A context switch. Yeah, maybe that's a better way to say it. But yeah, it's like removing context switches. You're in write mode, you're in edit mode, you're in draft mode or whatever. And so you don't have to leave that mindset to go elsewhere. So like if you have to go to GitHub or open your text editor, you're going to be sort of drawn to do something else as opposed to what you originally were there to do.
Right. And then also just the idea that you have to wait for a deploy, which like even the fastest deployments of static sites take like a minute. Mm-hmm. So if you just want to fix something quickly, then you can't just like fix it and leave. You have to fix it, wait for your CI or like your deployment if you're doing it manually. And then like you're not just going to leave before you check it. So you got to like wait to deploy it and then check that it worked and then you can do it. So like that friction, like it makes you not even want to start.
Yeah, so, I mean, even you talking about this, getting rid of context switches, removing the hoops that you were jumping through. So, from a distance, it always seems like you have a level of focus or you have like a level of productivity about you. You're able to just ship stuff and you know, you say like I want to write more, and you just write more. You know, whereas I say I want to write more, and then the next episode I'm like, hey, I want to write more. You know. DK blog or, you know, talk about this article or like write about this article I've been reading or whatever. That's one thing that I've always admired about you is like, do you have this level of focus or this ability to just produce content, I guess, for lack of a better word. In talking to you, it seems like it's no accident because it's like you purposely look for avenues to allow yourself to do that, whether it's, you know, thinking about your work-life balance. And that's something that you and I've talked a lot about, you know, personally, or even simple things like this, like removing the context switch from going from looking at your blog to editing a blog post or going from looking at your blog to writing a new post if the inspiration hits you.
I mean, I wish I knew how to summarize my process because I don't spend too much time thinking about it. But I would say that I think the thing that helps me the most is that I follow what I'm really curious about and excited about. And I feel like really fortunate and privileged to be able to have found something that I really enjoy. And also like not just programming, like I think the thing I actually enjoy is communication. Programming is a way to do that. Like you can build a website that helps you communicate a message to people, or helps them do something or just interact with them in some way. So like, that's why I like writing as well. Like it's just another way to communicate with people. So I think I found something I really loved and I've been pursuing it for a long time. Like I started getting the idea for doing like being like an independent app developer around 10 years ago. And I've slowly been working towards that goal the entire time, straying away here and there many times in between. But, I think I was able to find something early that I just was really into and just kept moving in that direction.
Well, I think something really key for me anyway, when you talk about this is when you say follow something that you're interested in or that you're excited about. And you have another post on your blog that talks about you sort of dealing with burnout, and coming back from burnout for you looked like pursuing something creative or something that you enjoyed in the creative realm, right? So like when I'm thinking back about on my life, I've never been like the best guitar player. I don't think like I've been the best programmer or anything like that. But when I can tell the times that I do level up, it's not that I'm like focusing on technology or I'm focusing on playing the instrument. It's that I'm being creative and I'm feeling like I'm being fulfilled creatively. And that allows me to, I guess, naturally just spend more time focusing on this thing, right? So to me, there's like two different types of focus. There's like when you're interested in something, you're able to really focus and block out the world because you're excited and you're interested about it. And then there's a focus of I need to focus, and you force yourself to because it's out of necessity, if that makes sense. And it seems like so far in my life that when I'm in seasons of focusing out of necessity because it's my job or whatever, it's just not as productive. I just don't yield as much results. I'm not growing as fast. And I just don't feel as good about what I'm doing.
I think like I've struggled with that as well. Like in jobs, like, I don't know. It does, like it gets stale. Like I don't think I've ever had a job for more than, I guess, 2 years. 2.5 years is my longest stint at a job. And I think it's just because it does get stale, like doing the same thing for that long, unless you're in a big company where you can move around to different projects and things. I think it does end up getting stale. And you mentioned like not feeling like you're good at guitar, even though you did it for so long. Like I feel the exact same way about everything I do as well. I think it's just like it's a function of who you compare yourself against. Like if you're comparing yourself against the best guitarist in the world, like obviously you're not going to live up to that, but
sure.
And I think it especially affects you when you're learning something new. Like I'm just getting more into writing now, so I don't really have too big of a following, and then I look over at these other people who've been, I mean, they've probably been writing for 10 years or whatever, and I compare myself to them and I'm like, oh geez, my blog post is only getting a few hundred views and they have like 7,000 subscribers on their newsletter.
Right.
So then that ends up making me feel bad about myself, even though, like, I should know that I'm just a beginner and I'll get there eventually.
Yeah. I guess that's just sort of always been happening to everybody, right? I guess it's not like isolated to any one person. It's just part of the journey. I guess it's part of something you have to learn how to deal with in the journey to where you want to go.
Yeah, and I think it's a good thing to get used to. Like, what's the saying? Like, you are a product of your three closest friends or whatever. So I think it's worth like trying to find surround yourself with people who are better than you. And like initially you feel bad, but eventually you realize how much you can learn from them, and like you can be motivated by where they've gotten to apply that to your own learning and your own life.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's sort of why I started reaching out to people like you on Twitter, honestly, is because I admired what you were doing, and I figured, what's the harm? It's only Twitter. You know, it's not like I'm walking up to people in real life, even though that may not be much different. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the friendships I've gleaned most from or felt most fulfilled by are people that I reached out to because I admired what they were doing.
Yeah, I've used Twitter for that as well. Like I use it all the time, and like it's just such an amazing place to find people who are like doing stuff and like progressing as individuals. So yeah, like I love it for that as well. One thing to note on just like learning new stuff as well. I've been thinking a lot about a little bit of like investing and how like compound interest works, and then like comparing that to learning and developing a skill in a product. And I think it's like extremely similar. Like it's really difficult for humans to comprehend exponential growth, which I think is why like a lot of people don't think it's, or they don't understand how or why they should start investing earlier rather than later. And it's the same for personal growth. Like I don't think it's a linear process to learn a skill, especially to build a product. Like you just got to do it one little step at a time. And like in 1 year, you might get to a certain point, but in the second year, you might double, and then you'll double again, and then you'll double again. And eventually you sort of look back and think, whoa, like I actually got really far. Like, how did that even happen?
Yeah, that's a really great point. Compound interest, it is hard to even like sort of visualize that, you know, but especially the point about it not being linear, because I think you're right. It's sort of like when you undertake your first web app or something, is there's like an iceberg that you're trying to unearth, right? And the more it comes out of the water, the bigger and bigger it gets.
Yeah.
It seems like grow exponentially, right? Like the number of problems you have to solve. You solve two problems and now you got six, you know?
Yeah.
But that's a great point. And I guess like part of that too is learning how to enjoy the journey. Someone said that to me recently, is like figuring out how to enjoy the journey. If you can enjoy the journey and enjoy the hard work towards the end, maybe that was you.
I think we were talking about that last week.
Yeah. Yeah. Arrival fallacy. That's what it is. Yeah. 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 That really struck home with me. Definitely. Yeah. It was very helpful to me.
Yeah. That's so when I was doing insomnia, like I think the first or the 2 years in, I mentioned like I got really burnt out for about a year. And I just like lost interest in the project. There's a certain point that I got to, like when running the business, where my bank account stopped going down every month and started going up. And that was sort of my benchmark for success when I started. It's like, if I can just survive off of this thing by myself, that would be amazing. Like, that's my goal. And then once I achieved that goal, I was like, oh, well, that it just feels the same as when I started. Like, I'm just,
yeah,
like the work doesn't end. There's still way more, there's still the same amount of problems that you have to solve. But now you've sort of like lost that motivation because your goal was the motivation and now the goal doesn't exist.
So I guess my next question would be then, what sort of things do you do? And this might, I don't know if you'll have an answer like off the top of your head for this, but like what sort of things do you do to help you make sure that you're enjoying the journey?
I think constantly just trying to improve yourself and learn new things. I think I get bored really quick. So if I'm like starting insomnia, for example, it was all really new and really fun. But then eventually you start growing it and you end up doing the same things over and over, like adding a new feature. Okay, it's in React, so I'm going to add a new React component. I'm going to update the backend, and it gets really, really repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
This probably goes against what I said before, but I try to every once in a while pick things just for the sake of learning rather than them being like the best idea.
Okay.
Because I think what really matters is that you're happy with what you're doing. So it is actually a benefit for your company if you do a creative thing that's different once in a while. Like, it doesn't necessarily always have to go directly to the bottom line. It could be like, even if you're in a big company, like employee happiness is one of the biggest factors of success. But it's so hard to measure that effect directly. You just sort of have to trust that it's a good idea.
Sure.
So yeah, a lot, like mostly I just try to keep learning and keep going.
How did you find yourself sort of like going into the choice of like open sourcing Insomnia?
I have always been tried to be really transparent with everything I do. Like, that's why I have a blog. That's why I write. But when I started a company, I was like, I'm going to do this thing. And when I started Insomnia, there weren't many people at the time talking about what it's like to start a company as one person, mm-hmm. and to run that. Like, how long does it usually take to get to sustainability? What are the problems you're going to run into? How you get customers. So from the start, I was like, I'm going to be transparent with this and publish my journey along the way. So I kept a blog on the site, released updates every month to say like, okay, here's what the revenue is. Here's how many people are using it. Here's the problems I ran into. Here's how I solved them. And then I just kept going and sort of used it as a way to give back to people who like would have been like me when I was starting. To help out. So open source was sort of the next step in that progression. It did end up being really beneficial for the company because it's a developer tool, and open sourcing it allowed it to become much more robust as a tool. But it was also a way to, like, for me to share even more with everybody, like what I'm up to. Like, here's the features I'm working on. If you want to look at the code, here it is. If you want to join me, like, just come jump in. I can help you out and discuss things and talk about new features and like review your code. So for me, like open source is sort of an extension of that transparent attitude, I guess.
Right.
You mentioned being an introvert. I'm also a pretty huge introvert, but I think I've found my way of communicating, which is just like put stuff out there and then people can sort of interact as they choose, in like a less intense way than like one-on-one conversation.
Right. In a less intense way than someone close talking you when you first meet them and stuff. Yeah, exactly. That's one of my favorite Seinfeld episodes, the close talkers. No, that makes tons of sense. So that's actually what I think led me to be interested in Somni in the first place. Is like I went to the site. I probably was along the same vein as you. Like I found Postman, ended up finding Insomnia, and I was like, oh, this is really cool. There's a blog. It's open. This is different, right? That's what struck me was that it was different. And I think the only other thing I could think of at the time that was similar was maybe an app called Cushion, which is like a financial budgeting for freelancers. But I always thought that was the coolest thing. Like I wasn't even a paying customer of Cushion for a long time. I just kept going back and was reading Johnny's blogs about how he was running the company and what he was building and why he was building them that way. In fact, if I'm remembering this correctly, Cushion's dev blog is actually what introduced me to Vue in the first place, Vue.js.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so I was sort of just going back and reading the blogs, and he mentioned Vue. I think at that point it was like 0.14 was the version a long time ago. And I was like, this looks really interesting. Hey, Paul, check this out. Because we were sort of going back and forth. Like we had been using Backbone for a while. We're looking at React a little bit. Paul really didn't like React, and he was my boss at the time. So I showed him Vue, and he was like, hey, this isn't bad. Fast forward today, we're both still using it. I make my living, you know, writing a Vue web app. So yeah, like even just people deciding to be open like that and share their knowledge, because that knowledge is hard to learn. It's hard learning. That stuff that you're just sort of sharing for free. It's been directly beneficial to me. And now that I think about it, with the Cushion example, has directly affected my career, you know, and introducing me to a technology that I became interested and excited about, learned and started using to, you know, to further my career. So I guess that's why I wanted to ask about the motivations around like open sourcing it. And you sort of naturally went into, you know, open startup, open life, like sharing information, sharing experiences. That's, I don't know. That's all really cool to me.
I feel like you approach it like a similar way. Like you have a podcast where you talk openly about what you're working on and what you're struggling with. And I'm sure you have people reach out to you and like just say like, oh, that really helped a lot, or like you introduced me to Elixir, or like things like that. And like there's no better feeling than somebody reaching out to you and thanking you for, I don't know, enlightening them a little bit, or like showing them a new thing, or I don't know, answering a question that they had that they thought you would never answer.
Yeah, it's why that's why Paul originally started it. And he asked me, because it was his idea first. He just wanted to help people. He says it all the time. He just wants to help people. And so, you know, he asked me if I wanted to do the show with him, and that's how we're here 207 episodes later. But yeah, I don't know. It's sort of like that in of itself sort of gives a reason to the why, I suppose, like why technology. For me, even with music, early on, I started teaching music because I wanted to help other people learn how to play as well, you know, I would play shows and people would ask, how did you learn how to do this? Or like, why did you choose that pedal? It's like talking shop, right? That was sort of the stuff I really enjoyed, like staying after the show and talking to people in the alley, you know, just kind of sharing experiences and sharing knowledge, I guess. That's honestly what drew me to the tech industry anyway, is that it seemed like people were so happy and open, or like happy to be open with you and share their experiences and knowledge. So yeah, thanks for doing that for me even, Greg.
Yeah, no problem. And that like totally makes me want to just keep doing it. Like just sharing. I think it goes back again to like figure out what you like doing. And I love helping people and sharing things. So like that's just another excuse to learn something new. Like I get to learn it and I get to share it with people. So like it's super awesome.
Yeah. And so I had a couple more questions, I guess, before we shut it down. But my first question was, I wanted to ask about the Keystone Habits that you mentioned in one of your blog posts. And again, I'll put all these blog posts in the show notes. But you specifically mentioned a Keystone Habit, and you specifically mentioned running. And I don't know, it seems like you've been just like sticking to that. And I wanted to ask, like, is running, are there other Keystone Habits that you have, or is like running the main one?
I think running is the main one. One time, so when I was burnt out, I did a thing where I forced myself to get up really early in the morning, which I thought was a Keystone Habit, but because I would get up and I would like get so much done, and it would only be like 10 a.m. and I'm like, oh wow, I did all this stuff already. And that motivated me to do like, well, it made me feel better about myself, then motivated me to like do other things because I had so much more time. But eventually I just, that wasn't the real problem or the real solution, because the problem wasn't that. It was that I was just unhealthy, I think. So running was, I think, my true Keystone Habit, because it made, like, exercise in general, it makes you sleep better. So you get better sleep, easier to wake up early. And also when you exercise, something about it makes you want to eat healthier as well. So, like, when I started running, I think those things fell into place because it just, I think, happens naturally with exercise. And then it just like had this positive ripple effect in the rest of my life as well. So, yeah. And I think this, another side benefit of running is just the meditative factor of it. Like, mm-hmm. you go out for an hour, you leave your phone inside and you just run. Like, I don't bring headphones. I don't do any of that. I just run and like monitor my body a little bit, like see how I'm feeling, think about things that have happened lately, or just like blank out and enjoy the outdoors.
That's so interesting to me, because I'm not, so you'll run, you'll go outside without headphones. There was a tweet that I have seen popping up a few times, but essentially the story goes that someone's on a subway somewhere and they saw someone just sitting by themselves with no phone, like a psychopath, or like maybe in line at Starbucks for coffee or whatever, right? Like the joke was that the person didn't have a piece of technology, they didn't have headphones in their ears, and that was weird to the person. And for me, I've been thinking about this more and more. I actually talked to you about this earlier today, but I've been thinking about this more and more. So for as long as I can remember, especially like programming and working, like I just listen to music all day long. So there's never really any silence. If I'm cooking, I'm listening to a podcast. If I'm cleaning, I'm listening to a podcast. If I'm working, there's like, you know, background music on. If I'm at the gym running, you know, I have headphones in my ears. I've been using the Nike Running Club app. So there's someone like, don't give up. If it hurts, run slower, you know. If I'm training jiu-jitsu, there's someone yelling at me, you know. So there's like never silence. And so I asked you this morning, I was like, do you listen to music when you work? And you're like, no, 90% silent. And that just shattered my world, because I don't do that ever. And so today, I actually only listen to maybe half an hour of music. And, you know, I had a few errands to run today. I had to take Watson to the vet and go to a few different places and things like that. But yeah, I just put my Bose headphones on and turned the noise canceling on, so I can't hear Watson. Like, he plays fetch with himself in the house and it's really loud. He'll throw the tennis ball on the floor and then go get it. So I used my headphones to sort of drown out the background noise. And there was, I don't know how other people experience it, but it's like the silence. There's like, silence isn't silent, if that makes sense.
Right.
That might sound crazy, but after a while that sort of disappeared, and I was like, oh, I'm just working. I'm not subconsciously thinking about this music or whatever. I'm just working. It was very different for me.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I think from what I hear, like, there, some people experience music differently. Like, some people can just listen to it and not have to pay attention. I think there's always a little bit of like distraction when you're listening, but for me, even like instrumental music distracts me, because I'm like picking up like the different like tones and beats and like getting motivated by the music or whatever. So it is distracting, even if it doesn't really feel like it in the moment. But one thing I notice, like I also listen to a lot of stuff outside when I'm just like cooking, like you said, or going for a walk. And I've sort of noticed, as I become more aware of just like my emotional well-being, that distractions like that are a sign of procrastination, which to me is often like you're avoiding something, some emotional feeling that you have inside your head. So you like distract yourself with music or podcasts so you don't have to really work through and dig, like actually work through the things that you're feeling. So that's like maybe a little bit different from working, but I think we often use it as like a distraction to actually the thing that we're supposed to be doing, whether it's work, whether it's like something we're stressed about, whether it's, I don't know, some other task that we have to do.
That makes a lot of sense. Thinking about Design Collective, especially, I've been working, this is the longest job I've ever had. And I've been here for like 3.5 years or something like that. And yeah, it's the same old, like refactor, make new feature, schedule meeting, whatever. And so it becomes sort of boring or monotonous. So having a constant sort of distraction in the background helps pass the time, I suppose. And especially working by myself, sitting in a room, you know, the same room day after day.
Yeah. You mentioned like the silence felt weird at first. Like, what did you feel inside when like it started feeling normal? Like, what were the like emotions going through you at the time?
So what's interesting is that I don't know how to describe this, but I don't have a lot of very vivid emotional feelings. So if you meet me in person, some people might describe me as very dry or deadpan. Other people have maybe said like, I don't respond very outwardly, I suppose, to things, situations and stuff. So, conversely, I don't also have really strong feelings about many things, I guess. I don't know if that makes any sense or if you can identify with that at all. So I didn't feel like anxiety or I didn't feel weird. I didn't feel unease. It was just different. And it was also hard to focus at first because I was focusing on the fact that it was quiet.
Right. The silence was a distraction.
Yeah. And then it sort of just, then I was able to sort of get into thinking about work, but also now that I think about it more, it's like, okay, if I'm listening to music, I'm going to skip songs here. I'm going to replay a song there. I'm going to change a playlist over here. I might have to pause a song if I'm meeting, you know, or if someone calls me, you know, so I'm like, it's another thing to interact with subconsciously. It's taking like brain cycles away from the task at hand. Right.
Right. Do you usually listen to music with words in it?
For a long time, yes. I don't find that it distracts me. I can drown it out. But more lately, I've just been into instrumental music.
Okay.
But yeah, hopefully my description of like emotionally reacting to the silence didn't sound weird. I just don't know like how to put it into words.
Last year, I started like trying to be more aware of like my emotions because I've never been good at that. Like growing up, especially as a man, like men are usually taught to suppress their emotion, like just be tough and suck it up. So you never really learn to like reflect on yourself and realize that you do have emotions. You're just not like looking at them or you don't know how to see them. So I've been just like more curious about that lately, how other people deal with it.
That's a really good point because I'm sure that's part of it as well. Because I had an upbringing a lot like that too, you know. Sort of just suck it up, deal with it or deal with it later or whatever. So that could definitely be part of it. But yeah, we'll have to talk more about that because that's a really interesting subject to me. But yeah, I don't know. It's just trying something new. Like you had mentioned it to me and it was a very foreign concept. And so I was like, let's try this out. And then I started realizing, yeah, like that is a pretty big distraction, I think, overall. And especially just never having anything silent. Get in the car, turn on a podcast. You know, it's like never just being. And that was one thing I wanted to ask you about too is, you know, like you mentioned running, how often, like you said, you can just enjoy the run and you're not thinking about anything, your brain shuts off. I'm sure you spend time like reflecting on stuff. And to me, that's been more like, and to me, that's been more increasingly important in my life is reflection and sort of analyzing things and thinking about things. Because for a very long time, that was something I didn't do. Something would happen and that was what it is and you just move on. And so now I've been like trying to analyze stuff more, think about stuff more, think about myself, like think how I'm doing, how am I doing professionally, how am I doing emotionally, physically, all that stuff. So it seems like you've been doing quite a bit of that.
Yeah, and also not just like reflecting, but also planning ahead as well. Like, it's so important. Like, reflecting is, like, it seems like the most obvious thing to do if you haven't done, like, if you're not used to it. But I think for me, I've started planning ahead more, which I had never really did. Like, it was always like, okay, what am I doing this week or today? Or, like, so, like, it's sort of like you're stuck in the present and you never look ahead. And if you don't, like, look ahead, you don't know where you're going, so you'll never get anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I've been, now that I've started doing that, I'm a lot more aware of the benefits, and then it like helps you keep going and keep building that habit. So you mentioned like reflecting on how you're feeling, but have you started looking ahead in that the other direction?
No, no. It mostly, I think, because it's a different, we're sort of in an interesting phase of life where, you know, I've been with Jamie for almost 7 years now, and she's been in school for 6 of those years. And so now, finally, like just now, it feels like we're in a place where, and not that I can't think ahead for myself, but, you know, she's my partner. And so now it's like at a place where we can actually start to think ahead maybe and plan a little bit more, because it's not like, all right, we have 3 years here, we have 4 years here, right? It was very time boxed before, whereas now it's not.
Yeah. So you weren't really able to, like, you already had like a fixed plan before.
Yeah, yeah. There's already a point in on the horizon that you're looking at. So, yeah, it feels very different now because that's not the case.
Yeah. I think there is something to say about shooting. Like, I guess maybe it's not like a, like things you described about like where you want to live, where you want to be, like those are more difficult, I think, to achieve, because they rely so heavily on like, can you even do that? But like maybe a different goal, like, I don't know, I want to write a book or like something like extremely way out there, but it's like, there's nothing that would prevent you from doing that.
That's good. So there's been a few things like, you know, competing in a jiu-jitsu tournament or, you know, thinking about like putting out music again or something like that. But yeah, just all in the very beginning stages of that because of the new life situation I'm in, I suppose. But
yeah, you mentioned the jiu-jitsu thing. That's I feel like that's a really good goal.
Yeah, yeah. It just sort of having to prepare. That's partly where running comes into, because prepare physically, mentally as well. But also, if I lose 10 pounds, I'm not in the super heavyweight bracket. So if I get down, because I'm like 225 right now. So if I get down to like 215, 210, then I don't have to fight giants.
Right.
But yeah, just, I don't know. It's sort of like, again, like it all sort of relates back to tech or whatever too, because it's the same thing. Like, you know, in Design Collective, if I don't stop and take stock, if I start a new feature without thinking about the resources I've already programmed, I might reprogram a module that already exists, or I might re-implement a different pattern that's similar to another pattern that already exists, right? So a little bit of a waste of time, a little bit of waste of effort and money there, but definitely like trying to think to apply that to my life is hard. It's easier for me to think about that in the context of programming my job than it is to think about the future and interpersonally.
Right, yeah. There's something about, like, I don't know, treating yourself as if you're a third person is, like, really difficult. Like, it's so easy to just be like, oh, yeah, I don't need to exercise. Like, what? Like, it's so hard to prioritize yourself, because I think it feels, I don't know, it feels like you can just suck it up and just get by with what you're doing already.
Right. Until you turn 30 and you get out of bed and your back, like you pull your back muscles in.
Yeah. 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 I feel so old already just from sitting so much over the last decade.
That was one thing that was very apparent to me with jiu-jitsu too, is that you could tell the people that had desk jobs from the people that didn't in their hip flexibility.
Oh yeah.
And how well they could use their core. It was immediately apparent that my hips were weak and not flexible.
So what's sort of the side effect of that in jiu-jitsu?
Just flexibility and mobility, like not being able to move a way that you need to, or be flexible enough to move a way that you need to defend yourself or you know, win the upper hand in a situation, someone's more flexible than you, then, you know, they can wiggle out of a situation where you wouldn't be able to.
Right.
A lot of it also comes into like, you know, minimizing injuries. So if your arm is getting attacked and your shoulders are not, you know, if your shoulders are tight and your shoulders are weak, then you're much more prone to a broken shoulder or an injured shoulder or a torn, you know, rotator cuff or something similar. Whereas someone that, is not weak, their body A, like, recovers faster, and B, they're less prone to those injuries in the first place.
Right. I have a lot of experience with that, with running. I've always wanted to be a runner. Like, I really enjoy it when I get to the point where I can, like, I can run more than a few kilometers at a time. But I always ended up getting injured, and I never knew why. I thought I was just, like, overexerting myself or, like, trying too hard, but like the last couple of years when I've tried to run, like I haven't even been trying hard and I get injured. But this last time, I forget how I found this. I think some podcast I was listening to mentioned it, but apparently like the psoas muscle, like the one that connects your like hip to your spine or like somewhere in there to like lift your leg up, is really tight. Like you said, with people with desk jobs. And if you run with a tight psoas muscle, like your form is completely screwed up. And so like, obviously you're going to get injured if you're like running with bad form, because like you do the same thing for an hour with bad form. Like, of course you're going to like use the wrong muscles that aren't meant for those types of things. And like, just like bad news.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially the psoas too, cause you're sitting. And so it's short, like when you're, cause the psoas, for people to know that it runs through, the front side of you basically. So it comes down through your groin area up through your torso. And so if you're sitting, it's shortened. And when you stand up and you're running, it's, you're expanding it. And if it's tight, it's going to cause a lot of problems. Psoas can cause a lot of problems in jiu-jitsu as well. I don't remember who, it was the Joe Rogan podcast, actually. So there's a pretty legendary MMA coach named Firas Zahabi that teaches actually in the TriStar gym, which is in Montreal.
Oh yeah, that's where I am.
Yeah, exactly. And so he was talking about a book called Becoming a Supple Leopard. And he was saying that in his gym and with his athletes and with himself personally, if he feels a soreness or a stiffness or a tightness, he attacks it. As if you might like take medicine for a cold, for example. He really focuses in on it because he says that's a symptom of something larger. And if you ignore that, you know, then it's only going to lead to problems. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of people, especially in jiu-jitsu and other programmers that have these back issues and these hip issues and these leg issues. And some people might have surgery. Some people like might develop sciatica, that, you know, there's a surgery to fix. They actually take the holes that the nerves run through and they make them larger.
Okay.
So if the sciatic nerves become inflamed, they don't get pinched. And all that can be fixed, you know, obviously aside from structural issues, it can be fixed by stretching.
Yeah.
And discipline in that area. But that really struck out to me was he's like, I attack it like it's a disease in my body.
Right. Yeah, I bought the Supple Leopard book a little while ago, and I forget how I got pretty far in it. I got to go back to it, but yeah, it had a lot of good stuff around that. Like, it's so focused on movement and like, I guess just being a normal human being, like physically what you're supposed to be, and like it seems so obvious at first, but like nobody realizes it. Like we all try to treat the symptoms, like you said, like. I'm going to bore a hole in like my body before actually just stretching. Sounds so ridiculous.
Yeah, I guess at some point it becomes so bad, you know, your body gets so tight that there might be like some more invasive medical procedures might be required, but it's an avoidable issue, which really sucks that so many people, because like I've had back pain before and it's terrible. It's like debilitating. And really, I think like through jiu-jitsu, I was like, oh, it's my legs and hips are really tight. That's why my back hurts. You know, then I learned about referential pain and all that. But yeah, it's really like a lot of it comes down to discipline and doing the smaller things. And I suppose, again, like, you know, keeping the tech metaphors alive, but it's like, doing, it's like paying attention to the basics while you're, if you're building an app or if you're building a business, paying attention to the little things. Are you testing? Are you asking your customers if they're liking what you're building? Are you building the right thing? You know what I mean? It's like checking in with things. And that's one of my favorite things that we did in jiu-jitsu was we would check in with ourselves. So before we started running, before we started training, before we started anything, we would all sort of get in a line and we would just move our bodies, like move your ankles, move your knees, move your hips. Are you sore anywhere? Is there something you need to be aware of? Something you need to be careful of? Something you need to stretch? So it's like that, you take that moment to relax and reflect you know, just trying to check in with yourself. That was a really cool lesson that I learned through jiu-jitsu.
All right. That's really interesting. I feel like I'm going to have to start doing that.
Yeah. Just check in with yourself. Professor Obo, from, Claudio Franza gym in Santa Cruz taught me a lot of life lessons in the short time I was there. He was a really cool guy. I think he said he was 67. He was running circles around all of us in the gym. two fake hip joints and a fake shoulder joint. He's like been a journey, you know, he's a sort of, done construction and roofing his whole life, but he's in there, you know, and he's after every class, he's like, you know, take care of your bodies. You only get one.
Right. He's obviously doing something right.
Exactly. So yeah, he, I learned a lot from him. Well, I really enjoyed this conversation, Greg. I know a lot of it, maybe the first half was about tech, but I really enjoy sort of the philosophical and just the interpersonal communication. Like you said, one of your favorite things to do is communicate. And, you know, I've mentioned it a few times, but you've definitely had like a really big impact on me, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. So the only thing I can do is really just, you know, say thanks and give more encouragement and just say, keep doing it. Because, you know, for the one vocal person, and I might be the vocal person here, but for the one vocal person, there's probably legions more people that aren't as vocal that are benefiting from what you're doing. So keep it up.
All right. Well, thank you. Yeah, that's so, it's always good to hear.
Well, I guess if people want to be more vocal, or, you know, just talk to you about life or tech or whatever, how can they best reach you?
The best place, probably go to my website, shire.co, S-C-H-I-E-R. And I'm just like, the only social network I'm on is Twitter. So if you want to follow me there, you can DM me if you want. Like, I'm super open to talking to anyone and everyone. So just, yeah, don't hesitate to reach out.
Awesome. Yeah. And that's something to mention too, is I've been saying Greg Shear this whole time and your last name is Shire.
Right. I would say that happens like 95% of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the record has now been set straight.
Yeah.
It is Greg Shire. Like Greg mentioned, you know, Rockwell and I are both always open for feedback, or also open just to like chat about anything. So feel free to hit us up. You know, mostly we're on Twitter. I'm at Sean Washbot on Twitter. Rockwell is at Schrockwell, S-E-H-R-O-C-K-W-L-L. And the show's Twitter is at DNCcast. And, you know, I mentioned a bunch of different things in a lot of Greg's blog posts today. So those are going to be in the show notes at dnc.show. And last thing, I guess, is just thanks again to Spec for having us and putting us out there and sort of, you know, just helping us keep these conversations going. So thanks to Spec. And that's all I got.
Cool. That was good.